Okay, well, thanks for the introduction, Ivan. When Ivan asked me to do this, I thought, well, I haven't worked on biofuels, or what we used to call fuels from biomass, for a couple of decades, so what am I going to do? Well, being a graybeard, I think I'll give the typical S7 graybeard rant about look at the old literature. So anybody who doesn't want to hear that, you can make a run for it now. I think Ivan mentioned this, the biomass multi-year program plan in DOE. I looked at that by way of investigating what there is for the current biomass program, since I haven't been involved for quite a while. And I see some familiar-looking phrases. I wrote a lot of things there, just verbatim. Renewable biomass resources into cost-competitive, high-performance biofuels, bioproducts, and biopower. Reduced dependence on oil, new domestic bioenergy industry, and national renewable energy goals. Those are phrases that are more or less, well, they're very familiar from the past when I was at Oak Ridge. So is this deja vu all over again? Because here's some papers that I got when I first, right after I first got to Oak Ridge. Fuels from biomass integration with food and material systems. And you see this, I don't know if there's a pointer here, but there's...
Use what?
The mouse. Bob Van Hook was one of my supervisors. Frank Harris was another one. And they're circulating this around. Gee, let's get something going on this. You know, and there's a guy plugging into a tree. So this has been around a good while. So there begins my rant. There was DOE's short rotation woody crops program. It started in 1978. Ann Fagy was the leader of it up in Germantown. And there are some words there, provide 3.4 petajoules, 3.6 quads, and I didn't bother to convert that to today's parlance, but it doesn't matter. 4% of total U.S. energy production by 2010. I don't know whether we've reached that. I don't know. If you count fireplace firewood, maybe so. Conventional wood resources, whole tree harvesting, and also short rotation woody crops plantations. There were many, many studies of short rotation biomass farming with trees. Steinbeck was one of the original ones in Georgia, growing sycamore. And then there's Paul Heilman's paper, test of close space, short rotation, black cottonwood. There were many, many studies like this, and they're back there in the 70s and 80s for anybody to read and review. And I suggest that we should do so. Tuscan, in 1998, in Oak Ridge, I think an economist, reviewed the program, DOE research, after 15 years, and said that the model species have been selected, poplar, sycamore, silver maple, and hybrid willow. There was breeding going on. That was a big program, and harvesting and handling. And the conclusion that fertilization would be required. Well, any of us who've been in forest soils for a while knew that from day one. We knew that any time you start growing shorter rotation crops with trees, which are very efficient in growing wood, when you shorten the rotation, you're going to have a lower proportion of wood and a higher yield of foliage and small woody materials, which have high concentrations, and therefore you're going to require fertilization. No big surprise there. And he says benefits of short rotation woody crops compared to agriculture. As research continues, answers to what we need to know will be obtained. At this point in time, the biological potential of short rotation woody crop supply systems have been verified. Okay. And we need large scale, basically scale up. And now it seems like we're starting all over again to me. Now maybe I'm a little out of touch, could well be. So concerns over sustainability have resurfaced again. They were there 30 years ago as well. But now they're coming up again in CSA News, American Scientist, many other. Ivan just mentioned other places where the issue of sustainability has come up recently. The high nutrient demands of short rotation crops were recognized very early. This is a paper from 1982, but we could go back even farther than that, and I intend to before the talk is over with. This is not new, not new at all. Even Hans Jenny, I dug up an old paper in Science. The carbon and nitrogen cycles of ecosystems will be curtailed and soil stability endangered. He's talking about biomass, or fuels from biomass, we used to call it. Because of possible climatic warm-up, we do not wish to accelerate humus oxidation and the concomitant flux of carbon dioxide to the soil atmosphere. So he was thinking ahead of sustainability and climate change questions 30 years ago. As a matter of fact, if you really want to go back, studies of soil-related effects of short rotation, high-yield plantations go back 5 decades. Here's a paper by S.A. Wild. He was actually saying, believe it or not, in that paper that the high-yield short rotations were good because they put more organic matter into the soil. So I don't know if we'd quite agree with the master about that these days. But certainly Peter Rennie had talks about the papers about this back in the 50s and 60s about growing plantations in the UK and how their short rotations were going to require or going to either deplete the soil or require fertilization. So decades ago, we knew about all this stuff. And then we had the second rotation decline in radiata pine in Australia. And that was a big deal. The first rotation, they got this incredibly high productivity, high growth, and guess what? High nutrient uptake. The second rotation, they had a fall down. And just as a sidebar on this, a few years ago I was on a review panel for the biosphere. And in one of their units down there in Arizona, in this enclosed thing, they had a cottonwood plantation. And they'd imported the soil, and these trees grew like gangbusters. They got huge. And they said, we don't need any fertilization. I said, well, you've taken the soil, stirred it up, and thrown it in there, so you have the Assart effect, the nutrient release. And you've grown all that biomass. What makes you think you can sustain that? Well, they're growing well. We don't need to do anything. And I can see that same attitude coming up today. So then comes this paper, and there's probably other ones that I'm not aware of. This is what I am. That the second rotation decline in Australia was cured by fertilization, site prep, weed control. In fact, not only cured, but they got better productivity than they ever had before. So just because you go in the first time and get a nice big response, a good growth of plantations, doesn't mean you're going to be able to continue to do it without fertilization, especially the high-yield plantations. So then we get to things that really do surprise me. In Tuscan's paper, he says, the most unresolved silvicultural issues related to short rotation woody crop supply systems relate to the use of fertilization and irrigation. How can that be? After all the studies we've done, maybe irrigation, yes, but fertilization has been around for a long, long time. Then this paper I found a while ago by Dickman. Fertilization remains an expensive and highly empirical endeavor, although we have progressed far beyond the spreading of manure. Few generalities are available to guide fertilizer applications. The only certainty is that fertilization will eventually be required after successive SRWC harvests. Well, that's for sure. The adage that recommended fertilizer regime for maize, if known, will work for SRWC is crude at best, but better than nothing. This sounds pretty grim. All these fertilizer studies have gone on, fertilizer co-ops, and this is all we know, according to these reviews. It's pretty hard to believe. So, and again, back to the 2011 DOE plan, just reading, I quoted the whole thing there so you could see I didn't take it out of context. a number of sustainability questions such as water and fertilizer inputs, establishment and harvesting of impacts on soil have not been comprehensively addressed. So what is it we've been doing for the last 50 to 60 years anyway? Is it opaque? Is it not understandable? I don't get it. And I'm looking from the outside in. I haven't been involved in this for over 20 years. So just being as out of date as I am, I pulled out my files on forest harvesting and forest fertilization. And what are they, about a little over 2 feet, pushing 3 feet thick. And I'm out of date. The real literature is probably twice that thick. So did we learn nothing from all this? Did you know that we have to start from ground zero again? What about the fertilizer co-ops? Don't they have anything to add to our knowledge? They had a different objective in mind, not necessarily, you know, wood grass or any of those, or switchgrass or things like that. But dude, is there nothing there of value? Have we learned anything from Carl Olaf Tom's work in Sweden? He's been fertilizing for, I don't know how many, 50 years there, and his successors. Hugh Miller wrote some really, I thought, groundbreaking stuff on fertilization, where you fertilize the tree, not the site, for example. It was very good work. Is there nothing there of value that, do we have to start again? Have we learned anything relevant to current biofuels program from the research specifically on biomass plantations? There was some, in addition to this old literature, there were a few papers at least specifically evaluating the sustainability and nutrient needs for biomass plantations way back when, decades ago. Did Helga and I contribute anything? We worked on it a little bit at Oak Ridge. Fertilization, I think everybody who knows anything about forest soils knows that you can, I'll say this generalization and somebody's going to argue with me, but you can typically grow wood on a full rotation without much fertilizer, because wood's incredibly efficient at growing biomass per unit of nutrient. And oftentimes, in fact, the nutrient removal in a wood-only harvest at full rotation is made up for by atmospheric deposition. When you start removing extra components, the foliage, and or if you shorten the rotations where the foliage is a greater proportion of the biomass, you start to get in trouble. This is not a confusing thing at all. It's a matter of balancing, like balancing your checkbook. Here's how much you take out. Here's how much you're getting back in. Eventually you should run out, right? No big thing. And one of the things that I think is true, and again, if you want to argue with me, I think nitrogen fertilization is the most difficult to accomplish. Nitrogen, as far as I know, will not stay in the ionic form in soil for any length of time. If you try to keep the ammonium levels high, the nitrifiers are going to come in and gobble it up, if nothing else. If you try to keep the nitrate levels high, they're going to leach away. So, whereas there have been lots of studies with potassium, calcium, even phosphorus added to the soil, and the ionic pool, the so-called available pool, can be elevated for even two rotations. For example, Turner's work in Australia showing phosphorus response in the second rotation of radiotopine. Nitrogen, you don't see that as much, at least, because the ionic forms stay low after the first pulse. And the ionic forms, that cash in the wallet sort of stuff, have to turn over several times a year to feed the uptake demands of the forest. So I think nitrogen is a problem nutrient for fertilization. And that's what I show my class all the time. So here's a typical thing for nitrogen. You have an increase in soil availability, and within a year, it's back down to pretty close to background levels. So whatever the trees got during that period of time, they have to recycle and maintain to get a prolonged response, because soil levels don't remain elevated for long. And I know somebody's going to point out, well, you're only measuring ionic pools. What about mineralizable? And then you have to tell me exactly what that is. But with other fertilizations, with phosphorus, you can have problems like that in phosphorus-fixing soils also. It can be even shorter time, you know, like the next day it's all absorbed. But it can also be true that phosphorus availability in the soil can remain for decades. Earl Stone did something on potassium years ago, and we all know about liming effects can last for 100 years. So I think nitrogen is unique and problematic. So here's what I show my class too. Here's a typical, again, I don't know who came up with this, but Timmer and Stone show this, effects in nutrient supply. So at first we have deficiency, growth limiting. Then we have a sufficiency plateau where you add nutrients and it doesn't really make any difference one way or the other. And then finally, with anything, including water, you can have, there, my pointer, you start getting problems. You can have too much of anything, water, anything. So the sufficiency plateau, I argue, for most nutrients is pretty broad. Sulfur, potassium, calcium, so forth. You can keep adding it. It'll just pile up in the soil in the ionic labile form, not do much. For nitrogen, it's pretty narrow. It's pretty hard to hit that peak. You hit that, go over that peak a little bit, you don't necessarily get killing the plants, although we had that happen in ponderosa pine when we over-fertilized, but you start getting problems, environmental problems like nitrate leaching, acidification, and so forth. And so we got two things with nitrogen. One is the ionic pools don't stay elevated long. You try to keep them elevated for a long time, you get in trouble. So I think that's those words there I just got through saying, so I'm not going to bother to repeat them. Except for the bottom bullet, thus, efforts to maintain high levels of ionic forms of nitrogen in the soil for prolonged periods, I don't think work out very well because they start feeding nitrifiers instead of the tree, well, in addition to the trees. This example, I have to throw in what little we did, I was involved in biofuels, fuels from biomass way back. We tried a fertilizer study in loblolly pine, yellow poplar, locust, and we did a annual fertilization of 100 kilograms per hectare per year, and then an annual fertilization but broken up into quarterly increments. So in the case of the quarterly application of exactly the same amount, we got no growth response, and we got a higher rate of nitrate leaching. We fed the nitrifiers, not the trees. In case of the single application, over here we got a growth response, both the poplar and the pine. I'm just showing a loblolly here, and much less nitrate leaching. So our interpretation was, you know, a slow-release fertilizer maybe, and certainly multiple applications, in this case, were not good at all. They were negative. So I think we learned something there. Then Helga later on did this study where she found that multiple applications were a little bit better, but the cost was a high rate of nitrate leaching. Studies of intensive harvesting and residue removal also date back a long time. We all know about Jim Boyle's work back then, Ed White, other people have shown that whole tree harvesting depletes nutrients. And a lot of us identified calcium as the nutrient that would be most depleted over time, even though, ironically enough, there's no calcium limitation known at that time. But reality sets in. Ruth Yanai and our studies, subsequent follow-up at Oak Ridge, showed that, in fact, this calcium limitation did not appear. So there's something wrong with our nutrient budgets. So in that sense, I'd agree that more research is needed to find out why, but probably is mineral weathering, deep rooting, things like that. Well, I got to hurry along because Ivan's standing up. I have 19 minutes.
We got about 8 minutes left, yeah.
Okay. And I have to mention fire since I work on, I live in the fire part of the country now, and we've been working on fire. The closest thing I've been working on to biofuels is effective fire and fire mitigation, mainly removing the biomass. You've seen that. There's this, I copied this flyer from the California forest scene where they've removed the biomass, and well, can we use this stuff for biofuels since it has to be removed? So prescribed fire is pretty trendy nowadays. People like to do it, but you can't do it very often because of the dangers, because of air pollution and so forth. And besides that, since I'm running out of time, I'm going to skip a few slides. When you do prescribed fire, you're burning off the nitrogen. 99% of the nitrogen in what's consumed is turned into gas and disappears. And so if you're going to remove that nitrogen anyway, would it be better to take that material away and use it for biofuels? The only problem is it's not economically feasible to do so. And last year I had a slide, but this is what this is what it's supposed to look like after fire, down after the mitigation down below. And that is a tinderbox waiting to blow up in a wildfire. I showed this last year. Basically, mechanical treatment for this problem is much more feasible than fire. And I'm going to skip really fast through here because I've already said this. So in conclusion, it looks like the renewed emphasis on biomass will emphasize carbon budgets more than we did in the past. Seems to place a little less emphasis on trees, maybe. Should include aspects of wildfire mitigation, I think, for at least for the Southwest. And again, my rant, many insights can be gained by a thorough review of the older literature going back decades. And we don't need to reinvent the wheel. So with that, I'll stop.
Thank you, Dale. We have questions for Dale. We have about 5 minutes for questions. Well, Dale, you showed a variety of papers from quite a while ago about inorganic and forest nutrition. In your awareness of that old literature, how long ago did people start addressing organic ed sources? And I don't just mean urea fertilization, but generally, how old is this idea, which you alluded of the plants available in pools, including organic?
You mean organic nitrogen uptake by plants? Well, that's a relatively new thing, and I don't know, maybe somebody else in the audience knows more than I do, but I don't know that we can quantify how much nitrogen uptake is these simple amino acids, for example, versus ammonium and nitrate. How important is it? I don't know. I know that people have found that it occurs, if that's what you're talking about, but I don't know how important it is, you know, relative to the inorganic uptake.
Well, it doesn't have to be taken up as organic N for the organic soil organic N to be important.
Well, yeah, that gets to the business about mineralization. It's so-called mineralizable N. We could talk a long time about that. Because mineralizable N, you're cutting off the roots, right? So you can measure it. Well, what about rhizosphere effects, where you have the rhizosphere actually stimulating more nitrogen mineralization than would be the case in the absence of roots? So that's an underestimate. It's an artificiality. So yes, certainly not inorganic N is not the only thing that can be used in the soil, otherwise plants wouldn't live long. But this so-called mineralizable N, I don't even know what it is. It's like a lot of our measures, it's an index, and probably not a very good one. Yeah. Well, Dale Cole knows more about that than I do, but the sewage sludges, I remember the wastewater applications were very effective, very high amount of uptake per unit of application, much higher than typical fertilization. And that's the exception where the slow input was very effective. For the solid sludge, I think it was more a problem with nitrate leaching and not so effective, maybe more like fertilizer. Rob or Dale, want to comment on that?
Well, it's very effective. The real problem in terms of bioenergy production is there's not much of it.
Yeah.
If you take the entire city of Seattle, and you're talking about a few thousand acres a year. So, and in the south, what, 1 million acres a year fertilized with urea? So if you all of it's pretty much being currently utilized by land application, either ag or in the Pacific Northwest and forestry. But if you add up the increment of that, it's pretty small. But it is important. It's part of the picture. And it's very effective in increasing productivity, particularly on four sites.
For a long time, too.
For a very long time, yes.
Yeah.
I'll jump ahead and make a point from my presentation, which is that we calculate nutrient demand by repeated harvesting, and we never run out of nitrogen because the deposition rates are higher than
high.
The
mm-hmm.
accumulation rates. Is that yeah. unique to,
even with whole tree harvesting
yeah.
intensive?
Yep.
I'm surprised.
So we're the right place to enjoy that.
So if you fertilize...
You're lucky enough to have a lot of air pollution then, I guess.
So if you fertilize those stands, do they respond positively?
That's the
we'll
real
find
point.
Out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll find out.
Yeah.
We that's what you say.
Mm.
Yeah. There'll be a poster tomorrow from about fertilizing and response, but we can have 20,000 kilograms of hectare in a meter of soil still have a response. The key is finding out where it does and doesn't occur. Or we can have 5,000 and not have a response to fertilizer. So it's the key is to be able to identify which sites respond.
Yep.
Okay, well, thank you, Dale. We're going to have to throw up questions.